I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, the proliferation of smart technology has created an unprecedented explosion of self-surveillance. Devices purchased for convenience, smartphones, smart cars, smart homes, Fitbits, medical devices, and home security systems function as permanent digital witnesses 24/7. They're harvesting data about our locations, our heart rates, what we watch, what we read, and when we are awake. This data is being increasingly used by law enforcement, prosecutors, and the political state. Current legal frameworks, especially the Fourth Amendment, are stuck in the analog age and offer insufficient protection against high-speed AI-driven surveillance. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Panopticon. This is a theoretical prison design that puts the prisoners under the threat of constant surveillance, so they had to act like they were always being watched and ended up self-regulating their behavior in order to avoid being punished. Today, some say we are all living in a modern data panopticon. We are being watched 24/7 by smart devices, the ones that we carry around with us and fill our homes with. Law enforcement, prosecutors, and the political state can access that information and then use it against us. Law professor Andrew Guthrie Ferguson has written a new book about the problem. Your data will be used against you, policing in the age of self-surveillance. And Andrew Guthrie Ferguson, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Let's start off talking about the Fourth Amendment, an amendment that doesn't really get talked about enough, I think. What's in the Fourth Amendment? Why should we be thinking about that more often?
Sure. Well, the Fourth Amendment is in the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution. It protects against unreasonable searches and seizures. It specifically mentions protections of our persons, our homes, our papers, and our effects, our things. It usually requires a warrant to obtain things that have warranted what the Supreme Court has called a reasonable expectation of privacy. But as you can imagine in a digital age, as you walk down the street surrounded by cameras with automated license plate readers, reading your car with a watch and phone and car itself, you know, revealing your digital location, what an expectation of privacy is in this age is an open question. And the Supreme Court is wrestling with that issue. Lower courts are wrestling with that issue. And we all live with that uncertainty about what the Fourth Amendment might mean in a digital age.
One of the biggest weaknesses of the Fourth Amendment in this digital age is what the courts call the third party doctrine. What does that mean?
Sure. So one of the ways the Fourth Amendment has developed is sort of to say, if you give your data to a third party, and that could be a digital third party, say Google or Amazon or any of the connecting ways, like you don't run your own network in any way. You're reliant on some sort of a digital third party. That could be your bank, and if you use mobile payments, it can be your email provider if you email or text with other people. The general rule has been that if you give your data to a third party, you cannot expect a reasonable you cannot expect privacy, because if Google can read it, well, so should the FBI if they have some suspicion of you. The hard part with that is if there is no quote unquote reasonable expectation of privacy, the government, the police, can obtain that information without a warrant. So if you like Google, you know, something to the algorithm of Google asking a question that could be as sensitive of like, what are the first signs of pregnancy, or could be something incriminating, like how do I get rid of a dead body? The third party doctrine generally says that you don't have any expectation of privacy for that statement you sent to a algorithm owned by a private company, and the government can get access to it, arguably without a warrant.
So that's a huge weakness. That's a vulnerability for all of us who are going about our daily lives thinking that our information is our information.
Yeah, I mean, that's in some way the reason I wrote this book, which was to get people to start having that conversation that all of our smart devices and digital communication devices are surveillance devices. Like, you're actually purchasing a device that will watch you, and you're kind of doing it because you hope that that information will be helpful to you and your family or your needs. But the reality is, without sort of a corresponding legal protection that can be constitutional or statutory, that data is pretty much open for police and prosecutors to get access to it and use that data against you.
But the courts have found that the third-party doctrine is not absolute. In cases like Carpenter v. United States, the Supreme Court held that the using cell phone location information from a wireless carrier, it was a Fourth Amendment search, and they needed a warrant to get that. So, if we educate the public, if there's pushback, then these things can be dealt with.
So there are two points to that. So one point is that the Supreme Court has started to evolve and recognize that the existing Fourth Amendment, that was almost all created in an analog world, like a pre-digital age, does need an update. So I teach criminal procedure at George Washington University Law School, and I have to explain to my students like what microfiche is, because one of the big third-party doctrine cases involves microfiche at a bank. And I have to explain that back in the old days, we would go back, and I can't remember exactly how we used it, but sort of a little film that you would go back through, and these students who are not of an age where they need to know microfiche have to learn about it. The seminal Fourth Amendment case that created the reasonable expectation of privacy involves a public payphone where you had to put a nickel in and make a phone call, and you have to explain like payphones and then how this was the normal communication. And that law is still good law, and it is a law that governs the reality of all of us living with smart computers in our pockets, connecting wherever we go. And as you were saying, the Carpenter case is a case where the court did try to update the Fourth Amendment, says that the long-term aggregated collection of your cell site data, like right now, if you have a cell phone, you can be tracked, you can be located because your cell phone is connecting to the cell towers around the way, and you can be found using this tracking. No matter where you go with your phone, you can be tracked. And what the court says is you would need a judicial warrant to be able to obtain that. Just pause on that, though. That means that with a warrant, you can be located anywhere. And if the sort of criminal predicate is you're, say, seeking abortion services in a state that's criminalizing it, or maybe you're protesting a government that you think is making some wrong choices, well, that data with a warrant can be obtained. So warrants are protective. They're good, but they're not as protective as you might think they should be.
The thing about the cell phone towers is now we know that they don't really work the way that we thought that they worked. And so what gets me is not only can this information be used, but it can also be misused and misinterpreted against people. And you go into a court and you have these experts make a case about something citing this new technology and how it's used, and they can be wrong. We've seen it over and over again.
Yeah, you know, I began this book not necessarily worrying as much about how a authoritarian-minded government might be able to misuse your data, but more about how the future of criminal prosecution and defense is going to be data. It's going to be about digital forensics, as you're saying. It's going to be a battle about the digital clues that exist. And I wanted to sort of showcase the transformation of our sort of physical lives, like how our homes are now smart homes. Our cars are literally computers on wheels. We carry a computer that's revealing where we're going and what we're doing in our pocket, and how all of those pieces of data are going to be central in the future of criminal prosecution, for good or bad. Like, there will be people caught that could not otherwise be caught, and that might be a great thing. And there'll be people who are falsely arrested because the data will be wrong. We've seen situations with facial recognition where there's been a false match, but that's going to happen, as you mentioned too, with cell phone data and everything else, because we have so much data that it's really hard to get it right and accurate, and that's going to be contested in criminal cases going forward.
So we're going to come back from this break. We're going to talk about what is self-surveillance and why is this happening to us, and why it's just not it's a false choice to say you can just turn everything off and live off the grid. We're going to come back more with Andrew Guthrie Ferguson. His book is Your Data Will Be Used Against You, Policing in the Age of Self-Surveillance. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and The Source will be back in 1 minute.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Your data will be used against you, policing in an age of self-surveillance. That's the book. We're having a discussion with the author, Andrew Guthrie Ferguson. He is a professor of law at George Washington University. He argues that all these cool little devices and gizmos that we buy for convenience and entertainment, those smartphones, Fitbits, smart home systems, our connected cars, medical devices, it's building a vast permanent archive of evidence that can be used by police and prosecutors and even by the political state against us. Have we signed on to this? I mean, don't we have to have some sort of form of consent in order to get here? So you can call in with your questions and comments. You want to hear, how are you dealing about this? Is this news to you? What do you want to see happening? 833-877-8255. 833-TPR-TALK. So, Andrew, did I sign up for this? Because you know I have to click the box on the when I get a new smartphone and sign up. Is that in there?
You did. We all did. We all, when we purchased a smartphone or a smartwatch or any modern car that has a GPS-enabled device that, you know, tells you how to get to your kid's soccer game, or when you get, you know, a flat tire on the road, you can press a button and you get an SOS. That only works if you're being tracked 24/7. Maybe in your home you have a smart television that is recording the TV shows you're watching, or a Spotify account that records, like, to the minute the song choices you have. Maybe use digital communications to text your friends or email or social media, right? We are giving up that information. Each one of those examples is an example of a choice, a choice that wasn't imposed on us by the government. It is something that we decided to do. We decided that there was a benefit to us, and many times there is. The book's not actually a scolding book about the fact that you put a Ring doorbell camera on your front door. It's about the consequences of what happens when all of those networked Ring doorbell cameras can be accessed by police, how they can be used for evidence, and whether we've really thought through the trade-off in a way that we're comfortable with. And
informed decision? I mean, I wasn't aware of how much information they're getting about me and how much they're capturing. I mean, I just was told I had to agree to it in order to get the smartphone.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the reality of, like, we all sign these long terms of service agreements that have lots of small print that essentially says that you'll give up the information, usually to law enforcement, but of course it can be resold to other entities as well. You think you're only giving it to one company, but many times you're giving it to other companies that are just repurchasing the same data because it's valuable. And it's not the most of, informed consent. If you actually sat down with someone and said, well, what do you think was in this document? Most people would fail that test. But legally, you have, and it's hard to push back on when you have agreed to it. In fact, there's a case going up to the Supreme Court this term about cell site location, but through Google. Google tracks you using Google Apps or almost any kind of Google-enabled device. And one of the, you know, as it's been going up through the courts, some of the judges have been convinced by the fact of, look, you signed up with this. You knew you were giving up this data to Google. Why are you here complaining? You don't have any expectation of privacy. So it is a convincing argument to some people, not necessarily to me, but to some.
So we should be thinking about our Google search history should be a public information?
I think you should recognize that law enforcement can access even your most embarrassing Google search. And I think that's troubling to people, right? There are many a question that you've asked Google. You might not even, like, ask your spouse or someone you loved because it's embarrassing. And the fact that that might be available to law enforcement or police for either to investigate a crime or as more of an embarrassing, you know, surveillance mechanism should be troubling. It would be great if you could have like both, right? You could have this relationship with your data where you could use it for the purposes you want, and there would be limits on how the government could use it against you. But we don't have those limits in either federal law or state law or constitutional law.
So I'm not going to commit a major crime. I don't think, like, who cares if they are able to track me wherever I go. They're going to find out I go to work, I go to HEB, and I go home. That's a local grocery store. But then I also went to a protest or something that, you know, where the government, you know, the government doesn't want me to go like that. Is that going to be a problem?
I think one of the most interesting things about this moment in American history is that the people who might have had that reaction of, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, so why would I be worried, can suddenly see that going out with a protest sign that says no kings, or helping a neighbor who is being accosted by ICE or Customs and Border Patrol might make you a target. And in some strange way, the kind of aperture of surveillance has expanded to cover people who might otherwise have been privileged. There are plenty of people listening to this conversation be like, I live in a poor area of town. I'm a person of color. I understand surveillance all too well. It has always been directed at me. The cameras are in my neighborhood. The automated license plate readers are in my neighborhood. But strangely now, because of this sort of turn and what we're seeing the federal government doing, that sort of aperture of surveillance is expanding to hit lots more people. And I think the moment to recognize our own vulnerability, our sort of like digital exposure to the things that we have created, is an opportunity to actually maybe come together and talk about the limits that we could create around this data and how we could preserve some of the helpful data useful to ourselves, but also carve out data that police might not be able to use.
Let's get some callers in the conversation, 833-877-8255, and we have Sinclair. Sinclair, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, I was curious, too, of all these applications, these apps we download on the phone for our businesses and discounts, et cetera, but with AI, it reads machine language, and even though the specific industry of the application isn't trying to garner all this information about you, when that machine language interfaces with the AI, it can collect so much more than you realize that you're giving up. And it's just like, do you really need all those apps? And what is the manufacturer doing to guarantee that it isn't interfacing? Well, they can't really, but just food for thought.
All right, Sinclair, thank you for the call. Thank you for those comments. And so, Andrew, your reaction?
Yeah. It's a great point. And so I think what people should pick up from that comment is that you might be thinking that the data you're revealing is sort of data that you're intentionally revealing. Like you had to literally type something into the Google search to get an answer. What the caller is talking about is there is a whole back-end data collection system in your phones and your computers that is sort of unseeable. Like you wouldn't be able to see it, but it is also tracking you and being sold as a commodity. And so you might have like a flashlight on your phone. I sort of came as a free app, like, oh, great, I have a flashlight now on my phone. But the freeness is only that it's your data that's being sold and resold, and you can be tracked by the consumer data kind of equivalent of cookies, but on your cell phone that can be tracked. And in fact, we're seeing that right now in the immigration enforcement context where ICE is using this kind of consumer geolocation tracking data to go find the people that they want to identify. And what the caller is really getting at is that with AI and a new move to be able to sort of track some of that hidden data patterns behind, we are going to be even more exposed than we already are in the current reality of sharing data with everyone.
Do you think the big data doesn't want us to know this information?
I think that the compromise that has been sold to us, and I think it's a false sale, is that the benefits you get from giving up your data are worth the cost of the surveillance. And in some case, that might have been true if there really wasn't a government looking for this data or using it. If it really was going to just live between, you know, me and Amazon or me and Google, like that trade-off might have been okay. Like, fine, Google knows what I really like and what I'm worried about when I Google it, but that's okay. I think it changes when the government suddenly has access to it and can turn against you, because it changes like what you would be willing to Google. Maybe you wouldn't want to Google where's the nearest No Kings protest? Because that could be a trigger for someone to start looking at you and what you're doing. And so I think it is in the company's interest to keep the sort of data resale quiet. But I also think that perhaps we've seen a different balance come up because of how we are now watching police power become weaponized in ways we just hadn't seen before.
We're taking a break, and we're going to do some pitching for our public radio pledge drive. It's going to take about 5 minutes. And Andrew, if you could hang with us, that would be great. We'll come back. I want to talk about the tyrant test and find out more about this data and how it's being used against us on The Source. We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Garst, and I'm an immigration correspondent for NPR. Covering immigration right now is extremely challenging. A lot of the people I'm interviewing are hiding because they're too afraid to go outdoors. Something that I have really tried to focus on in my work is the humanity and the nuance and complexity of every human being, whether that is a 12-year-old girl trying to live her life in Minneapolis or a farmer in Florida. I think that we're at an inflection point in which we're really questioning our identity as a country, what we're okay with and what we're not. And that's something that I think is going to be a really big story this year. Your donation supports journalism that gets to the heart of the story. Please give today, and thank you.
This is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Your data will be used against you. It's an urgent warning about the rise of sensor-driven data technology. It's all around us. Sometimes it's in us. This can be weaponized against democratic values and personal freedoms. The book alerts consumers to the hazards of their own smart devices, raises awareness of how we're continually being monitored, both inside and outside our home. We're joined by the author, Andrew Ferguson, a professor of law at George Washington University School of Law. So, Andrew, was there a particular case or moment that convinced you that this had become a major civil liberties problem?
Well, I've been watching it develop for years now, and I really saw it as somewhat of a hard problem. Let me give you an example that's in the book that I think really crystallizes some of the complexity of this. So I think we can all agree that having a smart pacemaker is like the kind of innovation that would be great. This is a device that like lives in your heart. It keeps your heart going the way it's supposed to be going. It informs you about the health of your heart, and it also provides that data to your doctor, so your doctor can check on your health. In a case discussed in the book, there's a gentleman who had his digital heartbeat data taken with a warrant by police who went to the doctor's office and obtained his heartbeat to use against him in a court of law. Now, why were the detectives doing it? Well, they suspected this gentleman, rightly, was involved in kind of an insurance scam where he had fraudulently burned down his building and claimed the insurance, but really it was an arson. And they wanted to show that his story about what had happened, how he was running around trying to save all of his belongings, was untrue. And his heartbeat was going to be the witness against him. And to me, this is a fascinating challenge, right? We can all agree that these innovations of smart heartbeats and smart heart pacemakers is wonderful. That saves lives and is terrific. At the same time, we might be discomforted by the fact that our heartbeat could be used against us. And at the same time, these detectives weren't necessarily doing anything wrong. They had a crime. They were trying to investigate. And we created the data and it was available to be used in court. And so I've seen that type of puzzle show up again and again and again. And I decided to sort of focus on how our smart homes and smart cars and smart effects and smart bodies and smart cities are being used and transformed into evidence and what that means for our future.
The number to call in if you've got a question or comment, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. I want to ask you about there was this app, the Flow app, that women used to track their periods. And the here in Texas, this is really a big anti-abortion state. And the lawmakers feel like this is their top priority to prevent women from accessing reproductive freedom. And the data that some women had on this Flow app was being used to determine like who was pregnant. And is that fall into what you're talking about?
Exactly. I mean, again, not just talking about one particular company, but like, obviously, women who find themselves pregnant want to find out information about it. And then many women use a period app just to, even without pregnancy, just to keep a healthy lifestyle and understand what's going on with their bodies. And that data that could be like literally on a period app, but also can be coming from your smart watch or other kinds of medical devices, is being created. It exists. And if you live in a state that is suddenly going to criminalize a certain act, in this case, seeking abortion, all of the steps that you take to obtain that medical services might be tracked, from a initial Google search of early signs of pregnancy to the data that might be like revealing to maybe a text to your worried mother or a friend or your partner. Maybe it's the car that takes you out of Texas but is being captured by automated license plate readers from one state to the next. Or, of course, your phone that you can geolocate the data of anyone in an abortion clinic or a medical clinic that services abortions. All of that data is available. And if you call something a crime, there is no protection. Why? Because the only thing that you might have hoped for protection is the government would have to get a warrant before getting access to it. But with a warrant, they can get access. And honestly, the thing that struck me the most about researching and writing this book was the fact there is nothing that is too personal and too private that cannot be obtained with a warrant. So your digital diary, your writing to yourself, your period app, your smart bed, whatever it is available with a warrant, and in many times without a warrant because of, as you mentioned, the third-party doctrine.
Well, we were talking about warrants with ICE, and they had cooked up this administrative warrant situation so they didn't have to go through a judge. Is that something that could be used?
I don't think we need to worry about administrative warrants. Like, could it be used? Obviously, we've seen this administration push the line of what is used. But even with a judicial warrant, if you can call something a crime, and whether that is like seeking, you know, gender-affirming care for your child, whether that's like protesting the government, whether that's impeding ICE or whatever it is, then with a warrant, a judge will sign off on it. Why? Because you have a crime, you have probable cause, and you have a request for information that's going to reveal information. One of the things I point out in the book is that warrants just really aren't that protective. Actually, in some states like Virginia, you don't even have to be a lawyer to be a judge that would sign off on that. There are magistrate judges in Virginia, including the magistrate judge that signed off on the case that's now going before the Supreme Court, who had basically just graduated college, hadn't gone to law school, and here he is signing off on what will be one of the defining cases about digital technology and our future. And this is not, your Article III judge who's been doing this for decades. This is someone who's not even a lawyer.
Let's go to a caller, Kathleen. And Kathleen, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi. Something that I wanted to bring up, you're talking about data collection. I recently changed insurance providers, and they offered me a safe driver app. And I asked a lot of questions about this because while they're collecting data on you, they told me it's going to make you a safer driver. It's going to make you a better driver. And I said, yes, but you're collecting all this data on me that you can use against me if I have an accident or if I don't wear my seatbelt all the time or whatever. So my rate could go up, yes, but it could also go down. And I was like, well, yeah, that's great. Well, I downloaded the app and I started reading the terms and conditions, and I found out that not only was all that true, but that they also can sell my data. And they can also sell it, like if I'm looking for another insurance provider, they will also provide that data to another insurance company. And if I decided to take the app and use the Safe Driver app, I could save $50. If not, I was going to pay $50 more for my insurance. I decided not to take the app, and I'm waiting to see when my rate goes up.
Well, you're a careful shopper, Kathleen. Thanks for calling in with that information. Andrew, your reaction?
I think it's a great example of two things. One is, you know, the money saved or not is the cost of your data. They will make up that money by reselling your data to someone else and probably make more than the $50. But the larger question of this is an opportunity for you to buy into self-surveillance. It's literally an extra app that you are offering a private company the ability to monitor how you drive. Do you come to a complete stop every time at the stop sign? Do you signal before you take a right at 50 feet or whatever the law would be? You are being granularly tracked in order, in your mind, just for a cost savings. But you also, of course, I bet in that terms of service, had given up the protections of that data for law enforcement. So let's say law enforcement wants to find out who is going, you know, across state lines repeatedly, or who is, you know, driving in a certain area that they correlate with, like a high drug area or whatever. All of your data would be likely pretty much available to law enforcement to get access to it. And I think, as you're pointing out, these are the choices that we make every day when we either sign up for self-surveillance or not. And we're never thinking about, oh, wait a minute, this might also open me up to some kind of criminal liability. The last thing I'll say is just, I think it's so telling. If you're ever just driving on the highway and you have like a Google Maps enabled and it has the posted speed limit in your speed limit, and you show that you are actually possibly maybe speeding in Texas and other places, just think about if the government had that same access. Like, they could literally ticket you for every minute you were over the speed limit. Like, that's the surveillance world we live in. Like, that's what that's how granular the data is. They would know, and Google does know, every single time you're breaking the law.
So I think about that quite a bit, about how this, where we live today, and the system of fear that we have that's being put in place. And I see fear as the opposite of freedom. You know, you should be able to live without the fear that these things are going to get you. Do you see it that way?
I think surveillance and sort of the sense of surveillance is meant to limit, like, liberty, autonomy, freedom, and the ability to choose to do things you want to do. And it doesn't even have to be because of the fact that something will happen. Like the woman who just called about the app, like, if you know that someone is watching you every time you drive, it's going to impact how you drive, where you drive, and what you do. And there's that fear, even without doing it, that is really part of the harm of a world that is governed by surveillance. And you might actually distinguish that, like, well, surveilled by whom? You might be okay. I'm okay with Google, you know, surveilling where I'm going, as long as I get to the right place at the right time and I don't get lost. But I really don't want law enforcement to have access to that without a whole lot of high steps to get that.
We're taking another break. When we come back, we're going to get Martin on the air to ask his question. You can call in with yours. Also, we have Delilah will be coming on the air as well. You can call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And we are talking about Your Data Will Be Used Against You, the book. And we'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about your data. It is not your data. It belongs to all these big data companies, and they can use that against you at any time, especially if law enforcement comes a-knocking. Let's go to a caller. We have Martin. Martin, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I think it's a really important topic, and I wonder if there was any thought or consideration to the sort of larger risks to society as a whole. So rather than focusing on a certain individual's actions, looking at sort of like the sociological aspect about when, like, maybe certain news comes out, a whole group of people react in a certain way, and we can get this information down to, like, sort of the click, what people are clicking on in reaction to maybe a news post or something like that. And if that can be used to manipulate people to behave a certain way, to react a certain way, either by tech companies or by governments, of sort of like an authoritarian government like Russia or North Korea, how they might manipulate their populace using all of this data at their fingertips. And I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
All right, Martin, thank you for that question. So Andrew Ferguson, go ahead.
Well, I think there's always a risk about how information can be manipulated by people in power. I think we're seeing that in the debates about the centralization of various media organizations and other sort of digital information. But just as one piece of what you said and what you asked, right now, law enforcement is monitoring social media. It's monitoring what people are saying about certain things. That could be localized. They could be monitoring like various like gangs who they think might be involved in criminal activity and or violence. So they can get ahead of the physical violence that might happen in the real world. It might be more political. Maybe the sort of protests against ICE and the Customs Border Patrols in Minneapolis, it was made clear that the federal government was watching the watchers using various surveillance devices to see what they were doing. I hadn't heard stories about them necessarily manipulating that. I think it's more about using it to observe what's happening and getting ahead of it, and thus thwarting the watchers who are watching the watchers, whatever it would be. So that's very possible. But, you know, I think the fear that the caller mentioned is very real. And we've seen it in other cultures where we sort of centralize data and control data. And the information you get is curated. You can't see it all. You can't know it all. And that's obviously a pretty un-American way of living if you believe in liberty and freedom and the power to dissent.
Let's go to Delilah on the phone. Delilah, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for the call. I was listening and wanted to take it back a little bit to the abortion conversation. And, you know, ever since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, I remember when that happened, there was a lot of discussion about period tracking apps. You know, those who get their periods, part of, you know, taking care of your reproductive health, whether you're trying to conceive or not, is tracking your period. And there's a lot of applications, and I'm sure even more tech since then, to help you track these cycles, and whether you're trying to conceive or not. And there was a lot of concern regarding the privacy of these apps. I remember a really big one. I think it was called Flow. I don't remember exactly. Don't quote me on that. It's not an app that I use, but it was one of the most popular. And they were selling that very, you know, sensitive data as far as, you know, when are you ovulating, when are you menstruating, things like that, for marketing purposes. And so it also calls into question when you're looking at these apps and trying to obtain them for yourself, looking at those terms and conditions and making sure, like, you know where your data is going, because considering the laws, depending on what state you live in, of course, as you brought up, we live in Texas, it could be quite precarious to have that data be able to be subpoenaed and potentially given to law enforcement if they don't have protections or encryption against that data.
Well, Delilah, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. And so that helps. So you have, Andrew, the Tyrant test. What is that?
Sure. Well, let me just to pull it together. So, like, the concerns of having information about your intimate life revealed through an app that you have given up information is very real. Obviously, some of the companies actually have taken steps to try to localize that data or prevent it from being obtained by the government. So you got to give credit that when people have moved. But the risk is very real, and it's not just in abortion states. You can have other sort of protected data systems that also are exposed. Just for, you know, in Texas, like, for many years, gun owners were really concerned that the federal government was going to come with a database of all the people who own guns, fearing that there'd be officers who would come knock down your door and steal your guns. Well, you know what? With automated license plate readers and other devices outside, like gun shows and gun ranges and where you buy your ammunition, you don't need that list. We already have that list through data. So it cuts both ways in terms of the protections there. And so the question is, what do we do about it? This book is not just trying to get people to interrogate their own sort of seduction of self-surveillance. It's also to offer some solutions. And one of those solutions involves what I call the tyrant test. And it's both a metaphor, but also a practical plan of action that says, imagine the worst. Imagine the tyrant got a hold of your data and wanted to use it against you. What systems would you have put in place before that moment? What protections would you create before to prevent the abuse? And the tyrant test answer is that you need to have, you know, legislative protections, laws, judicial protections, and expansion of rights. You need to have an executive that has some limitations on what they're going to prosecute. You should have individual rights when these things get violated, which they will, community protections. And if that sounds familiar, it's because the tyrant test was also the metaphor and reality that created America. Like, that's what we were worried about. We were worried about centralized power. So we created a, you know, executive and a legislative and judicial branches to separate power. We have grand juries and juries to respond. We have individual rights in the Bill of Rights. And we have federal and state, you know, power sources that contest it. And so the tyrant test is we should do that same idea, but with data. We should break apart the idea of centralizing data and controlling data and bring it back to those different power sources, because that contest will be protective of our personal liberty.
Andrew Ferguson is a professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. His book is Your Data Will Be Used Against You. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the air today, telling us all about it.
Thank you.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.